Creekside with Don and Jan. Welcome to Creekside with Don and Jan. If you care to live in harmony with nature and the land, and you wish to live more peacefully with all your fellow man, if self-reliant living is a big part of your plan, if you like to talk some politics with those who really can, this is the time, this is the place, Creekside with Don and Jan. Sit right down and make some space, Creekside with Don and Jan. Let's get started right away, Creekside with Don and Jan. No more singing, no delay, Creekside with Don and Jan.
Well, howdy and welcome to another episode of Creekside with Don and Jan. Hi, I'm Don Stover.
And I'm Jan Stover, and this is episode 320 on St. Patrick's Day.
Hey, Aaron Gabrock.
Exactly.
Well, I get my Irish up every now and then, don't I?
You do. You don't even wait for St. Patrick's Day.
No need to do that.
That's right.
Have I ever put green in your beer, though?
No, you have not.
Well, you're right. And neither would any true Irishman.
That's yes, exactly. We learned enough of the history of that we've Americanized that holiday.
Good and green. It's been sold up the river, and
the river is green in Chicago. Speaking of rivers,
I couldn't believe when I saw them with speedboats dumping dye into the Chicago River.
Well, it's plant based now. They had to get. I think I read an article in 1966. They had to change from just the plain old dangerous green dye with whatever else was in it was wrecking.
Most dyes are all petroleum based, but at least they went vegetable. That's
yes,
cool.
They did.
Maybe they're using spirulina or something like
they
that.
They could do that.
Well, they could. Mm-hmm. It's powerful stuff.
It's mighty green. In fact, we were talking about spirulina as an algae, folks, in case you don't know, and it's a healthy algae. And I went through a phase when I put it in everything, and you looked at me once and you said, I don't know that I want my bread to be green, Jan. So I backed off a little bit from that. But anyway, we've got a guest with us tonight.
We do have a guest. We have a blacksmith, Josh Nicolaitis, History Channel's Forged in Fire champion. He was the champion of Season 6, Episode 3, that had originally aired on the 20th of February of this year. And Josh is self-taught. You've been forging for a while?
I started off self-taught, and for the first about 3 years that I was doing it, I taught myself, did a lot of YouTube videos, did a lot of reading books and stuff like that. And then actually the last 2 years, I've been under the tutelage of Dustin Rhodes from Chopin.
Okay. Yeah. So you've got yourself set up and with a business that you run now called Nicolaitis.
Yep. Nicolaitis Bladeworks.
Yep. So,
well, tell us before we dive into your winning experience and your television fame, how you even got started wanting to take on this heirloom skill.
Well, I did a lot of primitive survival skill training over the better part of a decade now. And I started off just wanting to do bow drill fires because I'd watch a lot of the survival shows and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And then that kind of progressed into learning how to make shelters, learning how to make my own medicine and gather my own food and hunt my own food. And, you know, I've always been an avid fisherman, stuff like that. But it just got me back to nature. And it's such a sustainable lifestyle if you learn to do it right. And I got out there and was doing all this stuff. And a lot of this stuff requires a good blade. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't require, but it makes it a whole lot easier if you have one.
Good tools are helpful.
Yeah. It's hard to eat without a good blade.
Oh, yeah. But I would go out and I'd buy these knives that looked cool, but you get them out there and they just don't perform right. Either the edge rolls or chips. I've had knives break clean in half after using them twice. And I was just like, man, you know, I've seen these guys down in Tennessee that are making these blades. And I've seen, you know, Forge and Fire wasn't around when I first started doing this. But there's other shows where they show these guys making hand-forged knives. And they talk about how much stronger they are and how much better they are. And I was like, well, I could do that. And, yeah, I have a knife, quote-unquote, that is a screwdriver that I beat on with a claw hammer on a cinder block after pulling that out of the campfire a few times. And that's one of those things I hope no one ever sees, but it exists. It's in my drawer somewhere at home, and yeah, from then on, I just got hooked on it.
Well, that's kind of the can-do attitude. When you see that you want to be out in nature, and you know that the tools you're using could be better, to take that on yourself, mm-hmm. to teach yourself that trade, is that complete circle.
Right.
And if you had your choice of steel to use, do you go for softer stuff and then carbonize it, or do you start with a high carbon, or?
Well, I actually prefer to start with high carbon. I don't do a whole lot with like the smelting process or, you know, making crucible steel or anything like mm-hmm. that. I use known steel for the most part, but I do like to use a lot of the repurposed stuff. You get leaf springs off cars and stuff like that, trucks, old buggies. A lot of times those are wrought iron, so those are fun to play with. you get a lot of splits on those, but neither here nor there. 5160 is probably my favorite steel, and that's what they use in leaf springs a lot of times, or at least they used to. Sometimes they're a different alloy now with newer stuff because it's cheaper.
Okay.
But the 5160, it has the chromium content in it. It is high carbon, and it will hold an edge like no other, but it is some of the toughest steel that is readily accessible to the public. And I've made some really, really tough blades out of that. So it's probably my favorite one to work with.
Wow. You know, and I've never been fortunate enough to be around a forge. I have made a blade or two out of repurposed materials, and one of those materials that I thought was just amazing and would make a really cool knife, and I could be really full of it too. Maybe you'll tell me, are you full or are you empty? But are you familiar with those springs that wind up the hoses on a fork truck?
I have never messed with any, but I know what you're speaking of. Spring steel generally is a good steel, and really, the best way to find out is to take it to a grinder and look at your sparks. If you have real straight lines as far as sparks go, you're probably looking at low to medium carbon. But if you get those bursts, those explosions that come off of it, if you get a lot of those, that's a good indicator of carbon.
That's interesting.
The other way to do that would be to take a piece, heat it up to critical temperature, so non-magnetic, mm-hmm. and then quench it. And then instead of tempering it like you would a knife afterwards, you mm-hmm. just take it over to your anvil and smack it. And if you can break it, it's hardenable steel.
Oh, that's cool. All right. Well, okay.
You've educated him appropriately, huh?
I will try it. I will try it. And I will probably try it with charcoal, you know, as a base to start.
Oh, yeah.
And charcoal and air.
Oh, yeah. Hey, that's how I started out, though. I started off with just regular charcoal briquettes like you'd use in your barbecue grill, and they burn up very quickly.
Yeah.
I had an old air mattress blower that I was using because I didn't have a billows or anything like that, mm-hmm. so that was what I had. And I took an old grill, and I drilled a hole in the side and ran a pipe up it, and then, filled it up with charcoal, and it works really well. For a very short period of time. So for doing what you're talking about, that would probably work. Hardwood charcoal is better.
Cowboy charcoal, we call it around here.
That's already
doing its thing.
Yeah, and that stuff will burn a little bit longer. Then you got your bituminous coal, like your actual coal, and your anthracite and stuff like that, and both those work. I prefer my gas forge, and I know that's not the traditional method, but you get a much better product because you had that even heat source. You're not too worried about burning your steel out and stuff like that. So, I mean, it's just a means to a better, more consistent product.
There you go. And the bituminous and the anthracites are available locally. I mean, you can actually you can get it at Kaskaskia Supply.
Yeah, that's where I actually had a truckload that I picked up, I think, last year, and I still am working on that just because I don't – unless it's something that's too big to fit in my gas forge, I don't really generally mess with coal too much. But yeah,
and Walt, that's a freebie. I'll just go ahead and tell you that right off the bat. But we'll maybe talk later.
You're talking about a mention of the shop, huh?
Yeah, I'm talking about a mention of the shop on the
free plugs.
Yeah, free plugs. There we go. And so you use gas as your primary mm-hmm. heat source, and that's got a finite temperature range, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's more up to the controls on your actual forge, mm-hmm. how hot you can get it. I can get it up to forge welding temp, no problem.
Very good.
And that's how I make a lot of my Damascus is with my – here's another shameless plug. It's a Hell's Forge.
Okay.
And it's a two-burner forge, but That little thing, I tell you what, I got it, and the first day I was like, I'm going to see if this thing will forge weld or not. And sure enough, got it up to heat, no problems whatsoever. And a lot of people are like, oh, well, I don't think that's going to have enough power. And yeah, it's all about the valves, and it's all about the airflow that you have through it and all that good stuff. So, but yeah, it's been invaluable.
Fuel plus oxygen.
Yeah exactly.
And don't let the steel become the fuel.
Yeah, exactly. You start throwing sparks, you went too far.
Well, tell us what kind of equipment you have in your shop. If someone would come in and had never seen anything done like this, what would they expect to see in your shop?
Well, there's a question there. Which shop? I personally only have one shop, and that right now is set up in my basement. We are in the process of building an outside shop. I don't forge in the basement. I do all that outside. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've got my little 75-pound anvil, my Hell's Forge, and that's all outside under a canopy. Mm-hmm. Then I've got my 2x72 grinder, my chop saw, my bandsaw, hammers out the wazoo. Mm-hmm. Most of your hand tools, stuff like that. And I got a lot of stuff that was actually given to me by my cousins, because my late uncle had a lot of tools, and they were given to me because it was a Nicolaitis that was going to carry on.
That's nice.
Being a maker. Mm-hmm. My dad and my uncles, like, that's what they did. They made stuff.
That's
and
sweet.
Yeah. That got passed on to me, that love of making something. But then you have the shop that I do a lot of my work out of, and that is actually out in Chaubineur, Illinois, and that is Dustin Rhodes. He owns that property, and there's actually two shops out there. There's the main big shop, which has most of the bells and whistles that a bladesmith could ask for. He's got the grinders, he's got the power hammer. We're in the process of building a press because, with me being able to win the show, that provided the financial means for me to donate something to the shop. So sure. We're actually building a press there. And but then he's also got the coal shop, and that is more of a lean-to type thing, but it has a three-tier coal forge out there where you can get airflow coming in from three different directions, and you can actually get your broadswords and your longswords and stuff like that a whole lot easier in that coal forge because you're able to heat up more of an area at a time. Mm-hmm. Of course, then you have the inherent issues with coal. It's a whole lot easier to burn up your steel. Sure. And a whole lot harder to control the temperature. So,
sure. Well, the shops are specific, you know, obviously. Back in the day, you know, you shod the horse near the forge to a certain extent, right? So,
right.
So you're taking your materials very seriously whenever you're building a knife, and you want to be next to your knife making materials, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you don't want to forge out in the driveway and then have to run inside.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's the thing with the shop out in Chaubineur, everything's inside. We have it was a four car garage that we actually, well, he did it. I just have been adding to it as we go, but he actually turned into a blacksmith shop, and it's got the right ventilation where we don't have to worry about carbon monoxide and stuff like that from the forge.
Mm-hmm.
We've taken all the precautions that we have to. We have all the fire equipment ready.
There you go.
You know, it is a blacksmith shop. Fires happen. Well, I'm pretty sure I've tried to set that thing on fire a few times. But, yeah, it is a whole lot more convenient to be able to say, okay, well, I'm forging on this, but this has got to come up to heat, and it's going to be here for a while. So I'm going to walk 30 feet over here to the grinder and grind on this one that I'm working on, as opposed to, like, at my house right now, until I get my outside shop built and have all my equipment right there. I do have to do it. Like you said, Jan, I have to, I'm forging on this, and now I've got to run down inside the basement and hope that nothing happens outside.
Right. So that's a challenge.
Oh yeah.
So take us into the experience when you were invited to be on Forged in Fire and how that whole process began.
Well, Dustin Rhodes, like I said earlier, he was my he's for all intents and purposes my master smith. He's been the one that's been teaching me the last couple of years, and it's made leaps and bounds in the difference of the quality that I have blades that I make. He had been on, and I'd been out there learning from him for a while, and I just decided, you know what, I'm going to contact History Channel and see if we can't get another smith out of the shop on there. And I emailed them. They email you back a questionnaire, and you have to answer this laundry list of questions that they give you. And if you make the cut from there, then you go on to Skype interviews, and they want to see your work. They want to know more about you. You know, there's the background checks and all that you got to go through. And then from there, they give you a flyout date, and then it's months and months of waiting. And you got to love the hurry up and wait mentality. So I hurried up and I waited, and Next thing you know, I'm getting on a plane, going out to Connecticut, and get out there, and I'm the oldest guy, because they actually pick us up at the airport. All, you know, one guy just kind of comes around and waits for our different various flights come in. So you're just kind of hanging out with these guys, and I realize, yeah, I'm the oldest guy there. I'm thinking, great, I'm going to get beat by one of these young bucks, you know. And we get there, and the first day, I walk in, they're like, you know, you have to make this. And it was a Bowie. I'm like, yes, Bowies are right in my wheelhouse. Because, you know, that's a they originated as a combat knife, but they're also a very good survival tool. Just the components of it work well for what you need to do. They're an all-around good knife. And they're like, but it has to be this one, not your version of it. And that's what most people get. They're like, you get to make your version of this weapon from history. Well, that wasn't the case with us. We had to make a replica. And anyone that watched it knows that in round one, I kind of struggled because I completely forgot that there is a width parameter on there too, because it was the most parameter heavy episode. Usually they give you a length and that's about it. But this time they gave us a width of the blade. They gave us the length of the clip had to be a certain length. The length of the cutting edge had to be a certain length. And I got so focused on what I would normally focus on that I forgot all about that width parameter. So I struggled there, but so did a couple other guys. There was three of us out of the four that didn't make parameters. So in order to judge who would move forward from there and who would go home, they took us into what they called sudden death.
The lightning round.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And they actually took our knives and put them on an industrial size nut. So, I mean, like, this is a nut like you use to hold down a water tower, not... not something on a car, you know.
Big old chunk of steel.
Yeah, huge chunk of steel. So they took our knives and batoned them three times into this nut, and just as it would turn out, one guy's broke and mine didn't. So I moved on, and I was really, really worried because this knife was super thin, but it's a testament to our heat treatments and how the heat treatment, thick and strong, aren't necessarily one and the same. You can have a very thin blade be very strong. It's all about how you get that heat treatment done. So from there, went into round two, and round two went a little better. The only things that I had struggles and issues with was because of the failures in round one. The tang of my knife was a little offset, so then everything on the handle kind of had to be adjusted to that. And one thing would go wrong, and I just do whatever I had to do to fix it. And in the end, it ended up that my blade didn't take any damage, and the handle held up. It was uglier than sin, but it was there, and it held
the job.
Yeah, it did the job. And this is, I've had people say, well, man, that knife, you know, I didn't think you were going to make it through the first two rounds. I'm like, hey, I didn't either. I was just as shocked as you were. But that's not something I'd let out of my shop by any means. That's, you know, a time challenge that they give you these parameters, and it's such a stressful but fun situation.
Well, something like that I can relate to in that I watch a lot of cooking and baking shows with competitions. And it's the same way they'll say, you know, they have 5 hours to bake a three-tiered cake that has to feed 500 people. And they said, if we had a shop, we would never let this out like this.
Right.
But I've only got 5 hours. I can redo it at home.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
But so it's the best of what you can do with the time and perimeters, like you say, that you've got to consider.
Your cake did not fall over.
No. My cake held up.
And your knife did not take any damage out of the nut.
Yeah, no. And the nut was right after round one, and we got through that. And my knife, nothing on the edge, nothing cracked, nothing broke, nothing like that. One guy's did, so he was the one that was eliminated. And he's really just a great smith. Not just for a young guy. He is a young guy, but he is just a very talented smith. But just something to do with that heat treatment or the way he was hitting it, he had a stress in that blade, and it
tang,
broke.
There she went.
Yep. So, and like I said, round two went a little better. I got it together. It worked. When they tested it, it chopped through the moose antler, it chopped through the fish, didn't take any damage. And the only thing that they really had negative to say, I mean, they could have said a whole lot because that thing was ugly. But the only thing they really had negative to say was that it was a little offset, so just getting it in line to make the cuts on the fish was kind of an issue for Doug.
Hey, Josh, before we get to round three, let's take a break here and we'll be right back.
Hello, My name is Thaddeus Freed, candidate for Salem City Council. In the early part of the 19th century, there was a severe drought in northern and central Illinois, but because of its fertile reserves, southern Illinois became known as Little Egypt, and Salem, the gateway to Little Egypt. Today, our state is in bad shape financially, but Salem, again, is strong. Let's be the leader our state needs and show Springfield there's a better way than higher taxes on the hardest working people in the state.
For more info or to make a donation, please visit me on the web at ThaddeusFreed.com or find me on Facebook at Freed for Illinois, paid for by the Thaddeus Freed Election Committee.
Hi, I'm Val Gaffner, and I'll be sharing some of my best tips as I take you on two photographic nature walks at Earth Day, the Owl Creek Way. If you have a camera or if you have a cell phone with a camera, you have all you need for a great time learning to compose as we walk some of the paths in Patriots Park in Greenville, Sunday, April 14th. Hope to see you then.
Hi, I'm Mary Kinsler, and I will be offering nature painting through Cup of Canvas at the Earth Day, the Owl Creek Way at Patriots Park. We will have watercolors and Sharpies available and all of the supplies you could ever possibly want to use to create a scene or a landscape from the area, or a leaf for a flower or an insect or something from nature. We will have some pre-drawn surfaces available, and you will also be able to create your own if you so desire. So once again, all supplies available, and it will cost you only $10. Thanks.
Tickets for Earth Day, the Owl Creek Way, are available for purchase online at owlcreekgazette.com.
Are you ready to shake the winter cobwebs out of your head? Come celebrate spring at the Turning of the Tide Artisan Retreat. The Artisan Guild of Southern Illinois is sponsoring their second annual retreat on April 27th and 28th, 2019, at the Espen Sheed Chapel in Muskuta, Illinois. Registration is now open for artisan classes in a variety of mediums, such as silk painting, fiber dyeing, jewelry making, tapestry weaving, soap making, paper marbling, polymer clay, and more. Come welcome spring by learning a new craft or two and release your inner artisan spirit. Register now and follow us at turningofthetide.org and on Facebook at Artisan Guild of Southern Illinois. Again, that is turningofthetide.org and on Facebook at Artisan Guild of Southern Illinois. We'd love to see you there.
Okay, and we're back. Round three.
So they announced that the one guy's going home, and we're in round three now, and it's me and my good friend now, Dan, that are going head-to-head, and we don't know what to expect, so we're standing there, we're watching him, and Will Willis is up there talking like Will Willis tends to do because he likes to talk. Yeah.
What on the show is he exactly?
Will is the host. Okay. He's not a judge. He doesn't have any say as to who goes or who stays or whatever. But he is the host, and he does a lot of the explanations. So Will's up there, and he's telling us, you know, you guys made it in round three, and then he uncovers this thing, and it's a college mar. This is so ornate and pretty because, you know, Dave Baker makes all the finale weapons. Like when they show you the example before they actually go home to their home forges,
yeah.
Dave makes all those. And Dave Baker's a hell of a smith. I mean, he makes the he does a lot of reproductions for movies and stuff like that. So he can take a piece of steel and a picture and make whatever's in the picture. He's really talented.
That's cool.
And this thing was so ornate and pretty that we're both sitting there having little heart attacks. Of course, I'm smiling, and Dan is just showing it on his face because he's like, I don't know that we can do this. And I'm like, I don't know that we can do this either, but we're going to.
And this was the sword that was like George Washington's?
Yeah. Okay. George Washington actually carried this through quite a bit of his career, and there's several pictures where if you actually look, that is a sword that he has on him in the paintings that they did. And, you know, it was a President's Day special, so...
Oh, okay.
The Bowie was actually a Rough Rider Bowie, which was the group that Teddy Roosevelt led.
Gotcha.
That was the type of Bowie that they would carry.
Up and San Juan Hill.
Yeah, yeah. And then Washington's College Mar was just based off the sword that he preferred to carry. I don't make that kind of stuff. I make hunting knives. I make bushcraft knives. I make tools.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Doesn't mean they can't be pretty, but not anything that fancy and ornate. And so they send us home. And I'm sitting there on the plane thinking, man, how am I going to do this? So I'm running through all these scenarios on should I forge? Because it has a triangular shaped blade. Mm-hmm. It's actually bent because that made it harder to stitch that up if you know you got stabbed by that. Run through all these scenarios in my head and finally get back to the shop and I've got a game plan and I go into it. And day one went all right. And, you know, I was about 98% happy with my performance. Day two, I just got ready to heat treat the blade. And with it being such a thin, light blade, before it's heat treated, it doesn't have that spring aspect to it. It was still very malleable. And I knew just from pushing up against the grinder that there was some warpage issues that I was going to have to correct before going into the quench. And I hold it up to the light, and I see daylight right in the middle of my
blade.
Right
through the trifoil.
Yeah. Right through that trifoil. And I was like, man. And with that being hollow ground, you have that risk. There's always that risk that you're going to grind through. And I'd never done a hollow grind. I don't like hollow grinds for strength issues and stuff like that. But that's neither here nor there. Dave Baker would hate me if he heard me say that.
He might. We'll tell you.
Right. There you go. I'm friends with him on Facebook, so I can, you know. But, yeah, I don't like hollow grinds, so I just don't do them. I don't think that they're the best grind out there. But this had to be hollow grind, so I had to figure this all out. So, and it was probably a blessing in disguise that I did notice it, or that it was ground all the way through instead of mostly there. And then I go on there and my blade breaks.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I had kind of a grown man hissy fit, and I'm glad they didn't show this on TV, but there was one point in time where I broke that thing in half and threw it across the shop.
So they came out and recorded all this and then did the editing on that.
We had a shooter producer, and then we had a sound guy that basically... poor Shamari, he was our sound guy. He sat in the house the whole day listening to me cuss under my breath at myself. And yeah, poor guy. And then we had John. He was actually my shooter producer. And he was a younger guy, a few years younger than I am. We had very different political views and stuff like that. And we would have some really good conversations when the cameras weren't rolling. But he's a very nice young man. Like, he's very cool to hang out with. And yeah, it was a good experience all the way around. But
So you actually, since they recorded, they edited, but now you've taken us up through the point that you're, in day two or three of this 5-day opportunity to create this sword?
Day two was the meltdown, and I think by the time I'd actually broke that blade and threw it across the forge, which they didn't show, I had maybe 30 minutes left on the clock, something like that, maybe an hour at best. So I didn't have a whole lot of time. I was trying to weld this thing. I knew it was too thin to weld. Even if I dialed it back, I wouldn't have got the penetration I needed for welding. So it was never a good idea. But I tried to weld the spot up before I broke it, and that didn't work. So then I had to start forging a second blade. Well, of course, I'm working with 5160 that's maybe quarter inch, maybe a little bit bigger than that. Anyway, it was a fairly thick steel that I was trying to forge, and I got the tip forged in. That was it. So essentially, from day three to day five was where this sword was built.
And did they give you so many hours within that day? In other words, I was thinking if you made a mistake, you could just work into the evening and the wee hours of the morning, but that's not the case.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. Day one, you're given 5 hours, and every day after that, you're given 10 hours. So you basically get 45 hours to complete this blade. Now, if I were to make a blade and someone said, hey, I really need this in 5 days, you're probably right. That's how it would work, day and night until it was done. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm no stranger to running on 2 or 3 hours sleep, but that just wasn't
the case.
We aren't either. Yeah. So from day three to day five was actually the completion of this sword, and it wasn't what I wanted to turn out. But I was proud of it. It was something that I made in 3 days that most people wouldn't make in a month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from what I saw, that blade compared to the other one that was made, you did good. You did darn good.
Well, and Dan's is much more ornate and pretty. He took the time to really put in, like he did the Mokume for the pommel and stuff like that. He just really made a beautiful blade. And Dan's a really good smith, too. I mean, there's a reason why he was in the finale with me.
Mm-hmm.
But in doing so, he kind of skipped over some parts, and he knew it. Before we ever went into testing, he's like, yeah, I know what's wrong with my blade. He knew it wasn't very sharp, and he knew that he had a questionable heat treatment. So, I mean, he called it, but he was in the same position I was. I have to have something turned in to the judges so they can test something.
Yeah.
So it was what it was, and he didn't have quite the flexibility that mine did. I mean, his actually took the set and stayed that way, and it wasn't as sharp as mine, but... Like I've been telling people, don't let that take away, or don't let that be your opinion on his blades, because I've seen some of his work and it's phenomenal. He's a really, really good smith. So,
well, it seems like in all these kinds of competitive shows, the people competing actually do become friends with the other competitors, yeah. and they appreciate the skills. And it sounds like you did that same thing then.
I got a lot of respect for these guys. Dan was the closest one in age to me, so like maybe we just related more.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm friends with all of them. They're all really great guys, and they're very talented, especially, I mean, you get like John. John was our round two elimination, but the kid's 21 years old and phenomenal work. I wish that I had the skill set that he has at 21 when I was 21. Mm-hmm. You know, I wasn't even forging at 21. So.
So when they announced that you were the winner, what went through your mind?
Oh, I honestly don't remember. I just know that I was elated. Will asked me, he goes, you know what that means, right? I'm like, 10 grand? That was the first thing
right
out of my mouth.
Right to the heart of it.
Yeah. There was no beating around the bush on that one. Yeah.
Write me the check before I leave.
And unfortunately, they don't do that. I wish that was the case. But they always say, oh, you leave with a check for 10 grand. That's not the case.
Uncle Sam gets his cut first.
Well, no, actually, I was responsible for my own taxes. So I had to put some back for taxes and stuff like that. The problem was is... you have to have some incentive to keep your mouth shut.
Oh, there you go.
Because I shot this in August, and it didn't air till February. So there's a long period of time for someone to say, you know what, screw it, I won.
Yeah.
And they don't want you doing that because that ruins the show for everybody. So that's their incentive. You know, that's
it
your
works.
Incentive to shut up.
That's right.
But yeah, and it definitely works. You don't say nothing.
You say you heard it here first.
Right.
So you said then you've seen that money go into the business.
Mm-hmm.
And what else have you been able to gain from that as far as business related?
I mean, definitely the money was a big thing. I upgraded a lot of equipment and mm-hmm. replaced stuff. But also, there's been an influx of orders because I was doing fairly good business before. I had my repeat customers. I had steady business. Everything I made sold. I wasn't too worried about that, but then it just upped that from there and had a huge influx of orders to the point where now I'm having to tell people, you're waiting 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
Just because this isn't McDonald's, we don't just churn this stuff out
right.
immediately. And we want to make sure we give you a good product and stuff like that. So yeah, it takes a while and it's definitely improved the business and the prices of everything went up and people think, oh, well, he's just raising prices because he's Forge Fire champion. That's not it. It's the supply and demand kind of
thing.
If I'm going to spend 10 to 15 hours on a blade for you, it's got to be worth the time because I could be making more money on this blade for somebody else. So I mean, it's mm-hmm. one of those things, just getting people to understand that it's not an arrogance thing. It's, you know, time is money.
Yeah.
Well,
exactly.
And I think people that don't create that, you know, that make something don't see the time and energy mm-hmm. that it goes into it. It's like, oh, here's the end product, but not the 50 hours worth of work
right.
and all the thinking and the mistakes and the corrections. And we see that even with, you know, the Owl Creek Gazette. People think, well, it's a free publication. It didn't cost you anything to produce.
Well
blood, sweat,
right.
and tears.
And there's another thing, too, is, you know, whenever I work on, say, somebody's guitar amplifier, I will, in my head, be working on that thing
mm-hmm.
in my sleep.
Right.
And I can't charge people for that. I'd never be able to work on another one.
Right.
Well, 40 hours.
Right. Well, and you also got to figure, too, I mean, we're not perfect. There are times where I'll start out on a blade and spend 4 hours working on this thing, and then, whoops, the grinder took a chunk out of it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to give that to a customer, so now that is gone.
Right.
Right.
It got
thinner, it got shorter, it got something.
But I also cannot, like you said, I can't charge that customer because I have to spend another 4 hours replacing the 4 hours work that I did before.
Right.
So, I mean, there's all sorts of factors that go into it. And not only that, but and not just for me, any bladesmith that you buy off of, you're not just buying a knife.
Yeah.
You're buying, like you said, those mm-hmm. hours of work that are put into it, but it's also a piece of art.
Sure.
It's a functional piece of art,
mm-hmm.
but it's still art. And there's a whole lot that goes into the pricing.
So if people wanted to get a hold of you and ask where they could come see the knives you've created or if they can have a special order, how do they contact you?
Facebook is probably the best way. Nicolaitis Blade Works has its own Facebook page. And I think we're looking at 1,250 some odd people that follow the page now. And it's ever growing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably the best way. I am on Instagram. I am on Twitter. I do have a website, nicolaitisbladeworks.com does exist, but it's a whole lot of the old stuff because I've yet to update it since Forge and Fire happened. It's not a selling point. It's just a display of this is my work, you know. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and I also have a business card I can give to you guys too.
Okay, cool.
But it's still something that that you can be extremely proud of. And I want to thank you for coming in, Josh.
Yeah.
It was fun watching you on TV.
We would recommend anybody that hasn't seen you to actually go on there. And I don't know if they can find it on YouTube or is it still out there?
If you go on the History Channel, you can actually download the History Channel app. And if you have a cable provider, you can actually sign in with your cable provider. And
yeah.
I don't think you have to actually put in any personal information. I think you just have to put in which service provider and stuff like that.
We're on Sling and got it. So.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I didn't realize how we were watching it. Yeah.
There's a few different venues that you can go and look up online and whatever and watch it. And season 6, episode 3.
Because it really is fun to watch. I mean, just to see the testing of it after it's made and when they took the hog and and sliced through that and then the antler, like you said, and it was really fascinating to see what it had to go through to be tested and to watch the faces of the competitors mm-hmm. as those tests went on. It was like, is it going to work? Is it going to work?
Well, and that was really a weird aspect for me because I'm making those faces at that time, but they don't show you any of this stuff until the episode. You don't get to watch the editing process. It's all you're watching at the same time everyone else is. And everyone's like, oh, I was on the edge of my seat. I'm like, I was too, and I was there. Like, I know what happens. But yeah.
So we would recommend anybody that listens to this, go ahead and check that out and see you in action that way. Yeah. And maybe connect up with you on Facebook should they be interested in learning more.
Well, Josh, thanks for joining us on Creekside. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
This is the official podcast of the Owl Creek Gazette. You can get each and every episode here at Podomatic, and you can check us out every week. This is episode 320, and if you like it, let your neighbors know.
Absolutely.
Y'all take care now. Thanks for listening.
Good night, folks.
Bye-bye.